It's the confluence where the news comes together on 90.5 WESA. I'm Kevin Gavin. Pope Francis has accepted the resignation of Washington Cardinal Donald Worrell after he was named prominently in the grand jury report on clergy sexual abuse of children. Many of these abuses occurred or were reported while Worrell was the Bishop of Pittsburgh. Joining us by phone is Peter Smith, religion editor for the Pittsburgh Post-Gazette. Peter, thanks so much for joining us.
Good morning.
And in studio is Virginia Alvino Young, WESA social justice and identity reporter. Welcome, Virginia.
Thanks, Kevin.
So Pope Francis has accepted Donald Worrell's resignation. What exactly does this mean? Do we know yet? We'll start with you, Peter.
Well, it means that he is no longer Archbishop of Washington, although it is a very gentle exit. The Pope actually praised him in his letter accepting his resignation. So let me back up. He was Bishop of Pittsburgh for 18 years, and then he became Archbishop of Washington for the past 12. When he turned 75 a couple of years ago, as required under church law, he offered his resignation, but that was more of a formality. After the grand jury report, he returned to Pope Francis and said, please accept this now for what he called a need for the archdiocese to heal and to move on.
Okay. Virginia, what have you learned from what the Pope said? As Peter alluded to, it was very... And it was a nice letter, a praiseworthy letter.
Yeah, it wasn't exactly a condemnation for the actions that were detailed in the grand jury report or even really a direct response to the calls for his resignation that we've been hearing over the summer and some of the backlash that we've been hearing both locally and nationally. Things like, his name being removed from a high school, Catholic high school in Cranberry, right? It was just, he's the Pope saying that, defending Worrell really as he has throughout this process, Worrell being a very prominent figure and closely related to the Pope, saying, he's handled these allegations and charges with nobility. He's been really a model bishop. And so it's a little bit of a mixed message there.
I want to follow up on the word that Virginia just used, Peter, and that was the word defended, because in the letter, the Pope said that he could have defended his work as Bishop of Pittsburgh, and there was a difference between a cover-up of sexual abuse and mistakes, and also there was, he even referred to nobility of Donald Worrell.
Indeed. The reason that Cardinal Worrell offered his resignation was he basically had said, it's time to heal, it's time to move on, and yet... to go out with, even though Cardinal Worrell himself did not go out with such defensive statements, the Pope did add those statements, as did Cardinal Worrell's own chancellor in a new statement today. So I'm really wondering how this will be received. Will it be received as a healing gesture, or will it not? And to add to it, typically, here's the drill: when a bishop resigns, it's pending until the Pope accepts it. He accepts it at the same time that he announces a new bishop. There's a press conference later that morning. It's all very well organized, and the outgoing bishop is administrator right up until the new guy is installed a few weeks later at a service at the cathedral. That's usually how it's done. This time, there's no successor named, and yet Cardinal Worrell is being kept on as administrator for an indefinite period of time. It's about as gentle an exit and as affirming an exit as possible. And so, those who are critical of Cardinal Worrell, I cannot see how they would be too pleased with how this is being handled.
And, as far as we can tell, not only will Cardinal Worrell be staying on in some capacity within the Washington Archdiocese, right? It's looking like he'll probably maintain his positions within the Vatican as well. He sits on an advisory board that advises the Pope on appointing new bishops, and so he'll still be leveraging quite a good deal of influence.
So he'll still be a member of the College of Cardinals,
correct? As far as we know, yeah. Right? He hasn't been, booted out or laicized or anything like that, no.
No, not at all. No. And so that means for the next couple of years until he turns 80, if there is a vacancy at Pope, he could help vote on that. And in the meantime, he's making recommendations for new bishops, which is a very influential role.
Right.
Okay. To both of you, I know you're still working on reaction from local Catholics to this news, but leading up to this, since the release of the grand jury report, what have you each heard from, whether they're victims or supporters of victims or people just abhorred by the grand jury report? And do you think this might quell some anger? Virginia, let's start with you.
So, I mean, I will say within the diocese now, the institution itself, parishioners, there are really a lot of staunch defenders of Worrell. These are, you know, it was not so long ago that he was the bishop of the Pittsburgh diocese. And people saw that he really was sort of, you know, known as being proactive, dealing with allegations of sexual assault. There's a little bit of a mix there, right, in his response, as we've seen outlined in the report. But there are a lot of people who still defend him to this day. In terms of survivors that we speak to, I mean, the number one thing that they're dealing with their own healing, right? The one thing that they're looking for from the institution really is accountability. And so, as Peter alluded to, I mean, is this really the step? Is this really sending the message that things are changing and that we're kind of owning up to the things that have happened when you still, you know, call someone who's been implicated in covering up or not being as proactive or transparent about some of these issues as being still a model bishop? Well, I'm assuming that they're not going to be so hot to that.
Peter?
No, very well put. I think that while there are those who have defended Cardinal Worrell's record here, what the grand jury revealed that we had not known previously publicly was that it is more of a mixed record, that although he has spoken of zero tolerance from the start, there are a number of problematic cases that were outlined in the report. So I think people who are particularly survivors of abuse who are looking for a clear-cut statement of accountability, I don't see how they would see that here. On the other hand, there are those who say that, you know, maybe Cardinal Worrell was made the face of the crisis when he was actually on the vanguard of reforms, but maybe not as quickly as we had previously known of publicly.
Virginia, Peter used the term mixed record. I mean, Worrell, Cardinal Worrell and his defenders point to 2002, when he was one of the leaders to push the U.S. bishops to adopt an anti-abuse policy. But it seems like that the grand jury report said your words in that document didn't necessarily match your actions all the time.
Yeah, I mean, there's a well-known, well-cited amongst defenders speech that he made at that time amongst the cardinals when they met, and obviously this was immediately post Boston revelations in 2002. But you can go back to the 80s, I think in 88, when Worrell was, I believe, against advice from the institution and from even the Vatican at the time, meeting with survivors and their families. He even settled some of those cases, some of those predatory priests were laicized at that time. I think that specific priest actually ended up in prison. But also, he did allow, according to the grand jury report, some priests with allegations to return to ministry. And so there's kind of a clear case both ways. And was he only speaking out in response to some things becoming more clear to the public? Those are some of the criticisms that we're seeing now.
Peter, in reading your reporting, it seemed like immediately after the grand jury report, Worrell initially downplayed the scandal, insisting on his own good record. But then it seemed to he came progressively maybe to the conclusion that he could no longer lead the archdiocese. Is that a fair assumption?
Yes, and also while we here in Pittsburgh are focused on the Pennsylvania report, remember he was really dealing with twin scandals. His predecessor, Archbishop McCarrick, because he resigned as a cardinal, it became known publicly this summer that not only had he faced a credible accusation of abusing a minor, but also years ago, some of McCarrick's previous dioceses had settled claims against him for sexual exploitation of adults. And apparently these settlements had been on the books for years, and people were wondering, well, did Cardinal Worrell know about allegations against his predecessor all this time which did not really become public other than some corners of the internet until this year. So facing those two things really created more of a crisis of confidence for him. Plus, he was such a high-profile figure. I mean, he's one of the most influential churchman in the U.S. church. So he clearly became a very high-profile target, you know, kind of a magnet for the criticism. And, you know, there are abuse scandals blowing up all over the world in the church, too. And so all of that considered, he just felt, yeah, maybe it's time to resign.
Okay. Virginia.
I mean, I think right here in Pittsburgh is what we're going to be thinking about, what this is going to mean for the diocese and the state and here locally. And obviously, Zubik was, you know, sort of within that administration when Worrell was at the helm of the diocese here, was implicated in some ways in the grand jury report, but not as explicitly. And he's, you know, said sort of the first and last time that he's not going anywhere, Zubik, that is. So we'll see.
Well, let me follow up on that. Our last 90 seconds. So do we know anything about how this might affect any other leaders of dioceses in Pennsylvania, including Bishop Zubik? Does one resignation give any more opportunity for another? Peter, we'll start with you.
I'm sure some people will make such calls, the dynamic is different here. I mean, we're you know, as I said, Worrell was a very high-profile figure and was dealing really with the twin scandals, both from Pittsburgh and in Washington, whereas, you know, it's a different set of circumstances. I've not heard the same level of calls for Bishop Zubik to resign, and he has said he plans to stick it out here.
Yeah. The calls are there, right? I mean, especially the survivors, a network of those abused by priests have said, you know, he's got to go. They've called for a boycott on all donations to the diocese until he does step down. But Zubik is really in the middle of his own sort of efforts to revitalize the diocese. We've got the new reorganization plan, the consolidation and parish groupings that's going to be implemented just next week. And so maybe some of the response will depend on how successful those efforts are.
Very good. Virginia Alvino-Young is WESA's social justice and identity reporter. Peter Smith is the religion editor for the Pittsburgh Post-Gazette. Thanks so much to both of you.
I'm Megan Harris. The Confluence airs live from 9 to 10 a.m., but the news never stops. Find more stories, conversations, and more on our website at wesa.fm/confluence, on Twitter at WESAConfluence, and wherever you get your podcasts. The Confluence continues next on 90.5 WESA.
Here's what's trending in Pittsburgh. I'm Sarah Kovash. The executive director of the Allegheny County Democratic Committee has resigned from his post just weeks after being hired. The resignation follows controversy over several of his Facebook posts, one of which solicited donations for East Pittsburgh police officer Michael Rosfeld's defense. And the Pittsburgh Firefighters Union reached an agreement with the city last month, allowing firefighters to use medical marijuana, the only city employees explicitly allowed to do so. The union says it could help many firefighters who suffer from PTSD. Get more top news by signing up for our newsletter at wesa.fm/inboxedition.
It's The Confluence, where the news comes together on 90.5 WESA. I'm Kevin Gavin. The city of Pittsburgh has some old streets, many of them narrow, to help residents safely navigate the city. The Department of Mobility and Infrastructure was created not even 2 years ago. Joining us in studio is the director of that department, Karina Ricks. Welcome to The Confluence.
Thank you. Glad to be here.
All right. So how do you make the streets safer for all users when you have cars, you have mass transit buses, you have autonomous vehicles, you have cyclists, and don't forget the pedestrians on those streets? How do you do it with all those different folks and vehicles?
Well, part of it is to really acknowledge that we are sharing the streets with each other and that we do need to raise awareness of the travelers that are on the street. We need to make sure that we're sort of embracing everyone in our community. I know that everyone is in a big hurry to get where they're going and sometimes really just focusing on their own travel needs. But we do need to teach people to share the road. We do that by making the streets more predictable, more legible, if you will. So creating crosswalks that are easy to see, that are high visibility, that are easy to navigate, by creating bicycle lanes or bicycle facilities that give bicycle users a lower stress place to travel someplace that drivers can anticipate generally the movements that they're going to make by highlighting our transit stops and the bus stops, making sure that vehicles remain clear of those places so that the buses can get to the corners and enable everyone to board and to move around. So really looking at the streets so that they're designed in a way that is intuitive, that is understandable, that encourages the kind of behavior that we want to see from our travelers.
So would signage be a help? I mean, as far in advance of, you mentioned that crosswalk, if you would, maybe a sign, whatever it would be appropriate, 50, 100 yards farther ahead of that, basically saying crosswalk ahead so that you just don't see it when you come upon it.
So there's a funny thing about signs. The more of them that you have, the less visible they actually become. They become sort of that background noise of the street. Mm. So we do try and be a little bit more judicious about where we're putting signage out so that people are really drawing their attention to that when we need them to. But other than that, we really want to design streets that we call having self-enforcing design or self-regulating design, where the street itself, the place that we place the lines, the curb lines, the angles of the street, that is more instructive to the travelers than relying on signage at the curbside of the road.
Okay. One of my WESA colleagues spoke with you at the end of last year, December of 17, and you said one of your priorities for 2018 was to improve street design, make Pittsburgh a safe place to live, work, and walk, and you used the term Vision Zero. What did you mean by that, and have you made progress toward those goals that you outlined about 10 months or so ago?
So Vision Zero is this audacious goal that really is existing across many countries of the world, which is the notion that we really can eliminate fully deaths and severe injuries on our city streets and the travelers of the streets. We have not quite reached that goal of Vision Zero yet, nor did we anticipate that we would in 10 months. But we are making great progress in slowing travel speeds down. We do know that the speed of travel when a crash occurs relates very strongly to the severity of that crash and the likelihood of a fatality or a serious injury coming out of it. So just bringing travel speeds down, we've initiated a neighborhood traffic calming program. We're working with many neighborhoods across the city to put in place interventions that will help manage travel speeds, will help us behave better as neighbors to one another, and really move forward. We've made different improvements in intersections that you can see in Oakland and Squirrel Hill and Mount Washington and other places of the city that improve the crosswalks, shorten the crossing distance, improve the visibility of pedestrians. All of these are in service to this notion of a vision of zero traffic fatalities.
And those crosswalk improvements, are they part of the redesign, the design of some of the streets? And how do you, the second part of that question is, how do you do that? As I mentioned, you know, we're an old city, we have old streets, so how can you accomplish the redesigning and still make them beneficial to all users?
So our old streets are a major asset to us.
Oh, okay.
So many of the newer cities, if you travel to the West Coast or to other newer cities in the U.S., you'll see big, broad streets designed for speed, really oriented around automobile travel. That is not the way that Pittsburgh streets were designed. Pittsburgh streets were designed around walking and horse-drawn carriages and streetcars. And that is really one of the strengths that we have, is really embracing that history that we have, restoring that history. We do have narrow streets, and that does introduce some conflict between pedestrians and vehicles, but it also maintains lower travel speeds, shorter crossings. We are putting in more crosswalks. I'm sure you've seen all across the city, higher visibility crosswalks. And we're doing more paving than we've done ever before, so improving the quality of the streets.
Ernie Pyle described the city in an old Pittsburgh Press article as being designed by a bunch of hungry billy goats. What do you think of that?
Well, I've heard it described by any number of people as being a very confusing downtown, as having just some really contorted configurations of our streets. Frankly, I think we could use some more billy goats in our city to help manage some of the vines and invasive species that we have growing around our hillsides. But no, it's a great street. It really is a city that We have meandering streets where you really almost are forced to enjoy the place that you're in. You're surprised as you come around corners to see remarkable vistas, to see wonderful kinds of new discoveries in our city. It is not a city of rigid grids like Chicago or some of the other plain cities, but we are a city of very circuitous streets. But that's part of the charm and the interest that we have here.
Right. You were talking about some of the younger cities and the roads and streets that were designed for motorized traffic. Yeah, that can be an ominous task looking across six or eight lanes, and I've got to cross this thing.
Right. Yeah. I mean, sometimes I did come from Washington, D.C., I think, as we've mentioned, and I go back often and I think, wow, on occasion it would be nice to have slightly larger streets because we can then do a little bit more broader sidewalks, better bike facilities, dedicated transit lanes. But I'm very glad that we do have the narrow streets that we do have. It's part of the charm of this city.
I want to talk more about your plans, where you are in certain stages, and the future. But how have your plans in general been impacted by the year of the landslide in Pittsburgh and elsewhere, but within the city, of course?
Well, I can say unequivocally that was unplanned. We really didn't anticipate having more than 24 landslides that we would need to respond to in the single year. In addition to the landslides, we had over 6 major flooding events, and those continue to occur, particularly along Sawmill Run and Streets Run and some of our other waterways. We also had the train derailment, which was an interesting encounter. So it did throw us off our game a little bit to need to address all of those events that we had. I will say I'm very, very proud of the team that we have here across many departments in the city who really came together, responded to these unanticipated events in a very quick way. By and large, we kept the city safe and kept the city operating through all of these. There's still work to do as we address those slide events now, but they were a significant disruption in our plans for other investments. But we were able, I think, to respond to these major events and sort of keep rolling, if you will, on some of the other agendas. It didn't eliminate all of the other activities that we wanted to do as well.
Okay. We have just a few minutes left. I want to ask you about a couple of things. The bike lanes. There are still plans. Obviously, everybody knows the mayor is a huge proponent of that. Still, some people are apprehensive, even critical about all the bike lanes, saying they don't get used enough. They pinched on lanes for people with motorized vehicles.
That may be true. However, you know, what we do know is that 60% of the trips that are taken in our city are trips that tend to be less than a mile in distance. And that the vast majority, 40% of those are trips of less than a mile. 60% of those mile-long trips are driven in an automobile. That's a lot of automobile trips that really causes a lot of emissions, causes other kinds of issues. These are trips that we really can shift to walking and bicycling if we make it inviting, accommodating, comfortable to do. I've heard from people who are some of the biggest critics of the bike lanes that if we could really make them comfortable and safe, they too would use them if they felt that it was someplace for them. And so that's what we're striving toward.
In our last minute and a half, unfortunately, that's all the time we have. That is, tell us briefly, how do public-private partnerships play, what role do they play into your overall vision of making this city mobile?
Pittsburgh has been a leader in these public-private partnerships, particularly in the innovation field. So we've worked closely with some of Carnegie Mellon University, some of the spin-off industries of Carnegie Mellon, to really use our city as a testbed to advance the industry. We're working right now with Ford on the City of Tomorrow Challenge, but really looking at how can we demonstrate new innovations, new advancements, new ways to serve mobility and serve the people of this city by inviting them to partner with us to solve some of the critical mobility challenges that we have.
Okay. Give me very briefly a story how it affects an individual person, very briefly.
So we talk with people all the time. One conversation I recently had with an individual here, she's a mother of 4. She needs to start her trip at 6 in the morning in order to drop her children off before she herself gets to work. And then the return trip is taking her kids in transit with her for over 2 hours. And the question is, when are those kids getting healthy food? When are they getting time to study? And how is she advancing in her own economic progression. Right. And so these are real issues that if we can solve these issues for her, we can solve these issues for all Pittsburghers.
Well, Karina Ricks, good luck with solving those problems. Karina Ricks is the director of the City of Pittsburgh's Department of Mobility and Infrastructure. Thanks so much for joining us today.
Thanks so much for having me.
It's The Confluence on 90.5 WESA. I'm Kevin Gavin. Residents of Pennsylvania's 44th Legislative District will have a new representative come January. After holding that seat for the last 15 years, Republican Mark Mustio has decided to retire. The district is comprised of neighborhoods north and west of Pittsburgh, including Moon Township and some prosperous Ohio Valley communities. As 90.5 WESA's Kathleen Davis reports, two first-time candidates are running to replace Mustio.
Michelle, how are you?
It's a sunny morning in Sewickley, and Democrat Michelle Knoll is out knocking on doors. She's come to the home of Cindy Knights and her one-eyed dog, Miso.
And so I want to work on education at the state level.
Oh, fantastic. That's a priority for me, for sure.
Is it?
Knoll is a former teacher who worked with Pittsburgh Public Schools and also used to be an Avonworth school board member. Knoll has strong union support, and she secured the party nomination after running unopposed in the May primary. Knoll currently works with very small children, from birth to 3 years old, who have developmental delays or disabilities. She spends time with children and their parents to get them ready for preschool. She thinks her role as an educator will be a strength. She says she has helped families deal with challenges such as learning disabilities, poverty, and substance abuse.
We have very few educators in Harrisburg right now, and I think it would help. We've had some legislation where the General Assembly talked about taking away sick days from teachers. They've talked about arming teachers.
Knoll backs putting a severance tax on natural gas drilling.
That would help us fund our schools in a more sensible way than we are right now. It would make up for any funding gaps that we have.
A few days later, Republican Valerie Gatos is at an Eaton Park in Sewickley. She's grabbing a cup of coffee with a group of older voters. Four of the six are military veterans. They're asking Gatos about her stances on various issues. She often criticizes both parties. This is a district where Democrats slightly outnumber Republicans, and Gatos herself has given financially to Democrats in the past. But she is firmly conservative on hot-button issues such as abortion and the Second Amendment.
When I talk to folks, people don't mind paying taxes. They want to know where their taxes are going.
Exactly.
And that's where I think that both parties, in my opinion, have not done a very good job at fiscal responsibility.
Gatos left Pennsylvania to start an investment firm in Maryland in the early 1990s. She still owns a home in Maryland, and property records identify it as her primary address. Democrat Knoll contrasts that with her own 35-year history in the district. But Gatos says she has to travel a lot for her job, and Allegheny County voting records show she consistently votes locally. Gatos says she left Pennsylvania in the first place because the state lacks tax incentives for startup businesses. If she wins the seat, she wants to help change that.
I would love to bring a lot of those things that are working in other states and bring them here to Pennsylvania. I know how Pennsylvania can do better.
Gatos says she moved back to Pennsylvania in 2010. She doesn't support or oppose adding a severance tax to natural gas extraction. She says it's a complicated issue because Pennsylvania is the only state with an impact fee on the industry.
Do I believe that the oil and gas companies should pay their fair share? Absolutely. The question is how do you calculate that fair share and who's making that decision? And that seems to be where we need, as both sides, need to come to the table and not just demonize any particular industry, because this industry has bought a lot of jobs to this community.
Gatos also supports shrinking Pennsylvania's legislature and adding term limits to lawmakers.
These jobs were never meant to be a career. As I've said, I've had my career. Now it's my opportunity to give back.
Gatos squeaked through the Republican primary, winning by 26 votes in a four-way race. No matter who wins on November 6th, House District 44 will be represented by a woman for the first time. But one area where both candidates agree is that this shouldn't be as notable as it is. Kathleen Davis, 90.5 WESA News.
And for today's That Is The Confluence, where the news comes together on 90.5 WESA. On our next program, doctors say smoking's bad for your health. For city workers, smoking's going to cost them more in their health benefits. And we'll visit with Jane Werner, Executive Director of the Children's Museum of Pittsburgh. Today's program was engineered and produced by Kylie Kaczynski. Production assistance from Mick Stanelli. The producer of The Confluence is Megan Harris. I'm Kevin Gavin. Until next time, hope you have a good weekend of good news.